during the session to use the hashtag E12_SESS056. At this time, I'd like to welcome Dr. Deborah Everhart, who is the Director of Integration Strategy with Blackboard, and she also is an adjunct assistant professor with Georgetown University in their medieval science program. And also presenting is John Fritz, who is the Assistant Vice President of Instructional Technology at New Media at the University of Baltimore Campus Division of Information Technology. And during question and answer, if you would please come to the mic so that the online participants can also hear the question. Thank you, Dr. Everhart.
Hi, welcome. We're very happy to be here today. We actually have four different presentations, these two live and two recorded, because we wanted to be able to bring you a multidisciplinary approach to this important topic. Our slides are on the conference webpage. They're also on SlideShare. We've marked them as Creative Commons BY because we would love for you to take them, reuse them, remix them with attribution, because we think that this concept of how learning analytics can be a factor in students' behaviors, hopefully leading to positive behaviors, is a very important topic. We actually have more slides than we're going to cover today, so that's another reason for you to go out and take a look at that. So the questions we have in front of us, you're probably starting to hear if you haven't already. This is just a sampling of many important questions around learning analytics. Today we want to help you visualize what's possible, stimulate the discussion, idea sharing, and let you leave with practical advice for how you can begin to take advantage of learning analytics, because the examples we're going to show you today are real. They're available. These are things that you can actually do. This isn't like way out in the future somewhere. So what do we mean by learning analytics? In brief, it's, quote, the use of data and models to predict student progress and performance and the ability to act on that information, end quote. That's the definition from the EDUCAUSE Next Generation Learning Challenges. Learning analytics overlaps with the somewhat broader phrase academic analytics, which usually encompasses other institutional bodies of data like program enrollments, cost per credit hour, retention rates, institutional outcomes tracking, et cetera. Our work also falls into the category of social learning analytics, which focuses on the aspects of analytics that are related to the way learners interact with each other, how they compare behaviors, how they form social learning groups. There are a lot of opportunities in this arena, and they're coming to fruition very quickly. So what do we mean? Perceptions of progress, this phrase that we've used to tie together the different approaches that we're bringing today. I mean, literally, how do students understand their own progress through their learning materials? How do they know if they're succeeding? You know, is it a transcript? Is it a report card? These are obviously very old school. But even now, our traditional systems of reporting progress are usually after the fact. And for a lot of students, unfortunately, that's post-mortem. It's after they've already failed. It's after they've already dropped out or whatever problem they may have encountered. We're not giving them information about progress that's optimized to help them understand it in a timely way or is designed to help them modify their behaviors for success. New systems, such as badge frameworks, which we'll cover later in this presentation, provide clear pathways through scaffolded accomplishments. And they also provide clear explanations of what those accomplishments mean, not only for the learner, but also for employers and others who may be the consumers of those credentials. So this is an example, it's actually a set of examples of perceptions of progress, new school, not old school. Because today we have real-time information, the data exhaust of all of these different learning activities that can help learners understand and visualize their learning progress and modify their own behaviors for success. What you're seeing here is a dashboard built on an open source framework. It incorporates research projects from multiple sources, and they're from the Society for Learning Analytics Research. This goes beyond just statistics about activities and grades, but actually provides visual mirrors of learning behaviors and progress. There are suggestions, nudges, comparisons, social frameworks, ways for that learner to become a more strategic learner. So to talk you through these examples a little bit, this one, number one, learning dialogue analytics, this uses computational linguistics on discussion forums and blogs and other types of discourse in the course to help the students see how their language in those environments is or is not reflecting higher argumentative forms of discourse and help them change their behavior to accomplish that. This one, the Effective Lifelong Learning Inventory, you may have heard of this tool. It's a survey that a student takes for self-analysis of what their learning dispositions are and how they can improve in areas such as learning relationships and cultural curiosity. And they can actually see this spider graph change as their behavior changes. Number three, My Learning Network. This is a network of learners and their interactions, and the learner can zoom in and see that from different time frames or in relation to particular learners. Number three is a knowledge map so that the learner can look at relationships among the ideas that they're exploring, maybe in different courses. Number five, the mood graph. This provides a visual of emotions about learning, because learners are human beings, and by monitoring their emotional states, they can anticipate and better control anxiety and other negative factors. But of course, not all students are predisposed to use this type of visualizations, and we need to be pretty realistic about meeting them where they are. For example, new research by Glenda Morgan shows that 59% of learners are either, quote, ambivalent or time-sensitive, and or probably time-sensitive, about how they spend their time on their learning activities. And so we're going to need to better understand how learners are approaching their learning environments and what their understanding is of their own learning behaviors in order to move into this realm. Our next presentation is a recording from Dr. Janine Turner. She's an associate professor at Georgetown University in the Communication, Culture, and Technology program and also in the School of Business. Her research is in social exchange theory and the cost-benefit analysis, and specifically she's applied that to technology used in business. And in business meetings, she analyzes how people decide whether or not to focus on one meeting or multitask during a meeting. And recently she started to apply this research to students and their behaviors in their classes. Now, Janine is not an ed tech geek like we are, but when I started talking to her about this, she immediately got the power, the transparency of these visualizations for learners and for instructors. Her presentation is about 6 minutes. It starts with an anecdote. Let me give you a little bit of useful context for this anecdote. It's about a student who had been getting in trouble because he was asking questions the teacher couldn't answer.
About 2 days ago, I was talking to my son, who's 9 years old. He's in a communication, a computer class at school, and he was mentioning that he wasn't getting in trouble the previous day. And I said, oh, really? What did you do not to get in trouble? Because apparently he's been getting in trouble. And he said, I didn't raise my hand. When I had a question, I didn't raise my hand. When I was concerned about something, I didn't tell the teacher. I just sat in the room and waited for the class to be over. And I was appalled by his solution. But examples like these, experiences like these, I think create a situation among students where they are trying to figure out what is the game within education. What is it that I need to do to check out this box? And so welcome, I'm Janine Turner. I'm thrilled to be able to be there with you today. I wish I could be there in person, but happy to be there this way to talk a little bit about how students approach learning and their perceptions of learning. So I think it's important to think about what are some reasons why students take a class. And I think my son Andrew's kind of experience is part of the history of many people that go through the educational process that help to shape the way they expect engagement within a classroom. So, and I think experiences like that lead to the one that I think many people have in education environments, and that is that they take a class of a full degree. So they take it to check out the box. Their expectation is at the end of the semester, if they exist during that semester and do the take care of what was on the syllabus in terms of tests and show up for class, then they check out the box that they've taken that class. A little bit farther up the continuum of expectation and engagement is to acquire knowledge in a specific area. So that's to truly learn and understand what's going on in a specific class. And then finally, the most kind of engaged would be to share knowledge and view the classroom as a place where you share knowledge and create knowledge within that environment. So you go from a very limited engagement model of check off the box, or to the teacher and the student come kind of have a contract of what they're going to take away from that experience, which requires minimal engagement on the part of the student, and really I would argue minimal engagement on the part of the professor, right? Very much a distance approach. Then acquiring knowledge in a specific subject area requires an intensity to try to really understand what is going on the part of the student, and then the part of the teacher to try to better understand how they can meet the needs of that student. And finally, sharing knowledge and creating knowledge requires kind of an ongoing dialogue and conversation. So when we think about assessing a student's ability to be effective or a student's ability to learn in a specific environment, I think it's also important to consider how they come to that environment. A theory that kind of draws on this is a theory called social exchange. Social exchange theory has been used across many different disciplines. It basically is an economic approach to how it is that people make decisions on a cost and rewards basis. So if you go back to the student who is taking a class just to check off the degree or check off the class as a route to the degree, their goal is to maybe provide the minimum amount of engagement to still get that degree. And I think students have a variety of assessments in a semester on what classes they're going to invest in and what classes they would want minimal engagement in. And what I found is, as we develop online tools and as we develop different tools that we can add to a student learning experience or a classroom learning experience, we have to recognize to what extent do these tools contribute to different needs that a student might have on that continuum and which don't. I've taught a graduate class for several different years now on communication theory, where I've created a blog. And what the blog allows students to do is to communicate about the class and their thoughts on their reading outside the class. What I noticed at the beginning was many students did not see outside of class time as something that should be part of my purview, right? I was taking away from their ability to do other things by asking them to do additional things outside of class. They were always asked to read outside of class, but now I'm asking them to specifically contribute in another way, thus expanding the walls of my classroom environment, which is great if people are thrilled and excited and all about engaging around this kind of dialogue of communication theory. But the people that are more just need to take communication theory as part of this curriculum, less engaged. So the social exchange theory helps us to better understand the goals that underline the motivation for students to take a specific class. Because the idea that the teacher or the student is interested in the same things or the same things in any one class across very different classes across the semester, I think is a challenge for us to understand. Thank you.
Okay, so from that transparency, we move on to another type of transparency, which is found in badge frameworks, where unlike those old opaque transcripts, learners can show their evidence of competencies and the social structures that are behind those that can verify their accomplishments. Our next recorded presentation is from Erin Knight, who was the director of the Center for Next Generation Teaching and Learning at UC Berkeley and now is the Senior Director of Learning at the Mozilla Foundation. There she plays a role, a leadership role, in projects funded by the MacArthur Foundation, particularly for assessment in open learning environments and badges as alternative accreditation and credentialing systems. Oops, sorry, I need to go back a slide. There we go.
Hey everyone, it's Erin Knight from Mozilla Foundation. Thank you for inviting me here today. I'm sorry I can't be there in person, but this overlaps with our Mozilla Festival, so I am currently in London, or will be when you guys are watching this. I was asked to come here today to talk a little bit about badges and the open badge work that I do at Mozilla Foundation and how that relates to some of the stuff that you're hearing from my colleagues today. So there's a few slides here that my colleagues will show, but first I just want to start off a little bit by defining kind of what we're talking about when you hear the word badge. And really a badge is a record of an achievement, skills, competencies, affiliations, interests, really can be anything. And specifically what we're doing at Mozilla Foundation and with MacArthur Foundation is looking at taking this concept of badges that we've seen, you know, the Girl Scouts, PADI diving, Foursquare. I mean, we've seen it in lots of different places, but what does it mean to take that and actually create badges for learning and create this kind of alternative credentialing system? And I think one of the biggest opportunities is that with badges, we're sort of moving away from this concept of this thing, the recognition being this thing that you get at the end, a degree or even a grade that is abstracted away from the actual learning that occurred. And so with badges, we can actually capture or record incremental learning along the way, so that at the end, you know, whatever that may be, at the end of a course or at that sort of some point of mastery, you have a set of badges that actually tells a more complete story about that learner, about what they learned along the way, about the pathways that they chose. You can even better compare them against other people that may sort of have that, have completed the course together or got that same degree. And so So again, we start to just get much more fine-grained view into the learning that's occurred. And this also then, of course, plays into the sort of social reputational aspects of it as well. Again, badges are a visual representation of the things that you know or are interested in. And so it becomes kind of a currency in these learning communities for actually conveying that information, for finding mentors, for sort of building reputation. One thing to make sure is clear, and I think is an incredibly important piece of all this, is that when we're talking about badges, we're not just talking about an image or sort of like a sticker for the web. While I think the image is obviously important because it's a visual aspect, sort of at a glance, or even branding in some aspects can carry a lot of meaning, the badges themselves are actually a set of metadata or information that lives with that image. And that information defines everything that you need to know to understand that badge. So things like who issued it, when it was issued, who it was issued to, what the criteria for the badge is, so what the learner actually had to do to earn the badge or prove to do the badge, to earn the badge. If the badge has expired, an option for the evidence itself, like pointing back to the artifact that the learner has done. So the idea is all of that lives as sort of metadata, or it's called a JSON blob, but actually is lives with that image and then is transferred across this ecosystem or wherever the learner wants it to go, so that anybody looking at the badge actually has all that information behind it. So that's, to me, again, a pretty important thing to distinguish here, because again, like everything that we're talking about with learning analytics and all of that, like that is the sort of meat behind the assessment, behind the demonstration of learning, And the badge then, again, is that sort of record of that, is the thing that holds that information and then allows you to share it around and combine it with other things. It's also worth noting that when we talk about this, we're talking about it at the ecosystem level, not just individual badge systems. So while there's certainly a lot of value in each badge system for those various learning experiences, you know, motivation, reputation, you know, discovering new learning, the way that at least we're operating at Mozilla is at this ecosystem level where you have badge issuers, so all of the learning providers, you have the earner or the learner that is the sort of key central point, and then you have the organizations or people on the other end that are consuming or displaying the badges. So there's this kind of end-to-end chain where the value is sort of passed along. So at the issuer side, you know, that's where the learning experiences are happening. Again, the badges can help motivate those, can help signal learning, can help find mentors, create community, all of that with sort of heighten those learning experiences. But then those badges then are sort of stored or passed through the Mozilla Open Badge Infrastructure, which I'll explain a little bit more about in a second, where that learner actually collects all those badges and can create groups of them, can create narratives around them, and actually start to build identity for various audiences. And then at the other end, once that learner has decided to share those badges, then there's various organizations, employers, institutions that can actually use those badges to understand that learner more and find better fits for jobs or issue credit, that kind of thing. So on the next slide, it's just a quick set of screenshots of actually an old version of the Mozilla Badge Infrastructure. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, but it's just, you know, Mozilla is building the sort of technical plumbing, if you will, to make this ecosystem that I've been talking about possible. So that's the specification that I mentioned before that makes badges interoperable, defines what data should live with badges and allows them to work together. And then this concept of the badge backpack, which is a repository for earners to actually store their badges. So the idea, again, is that I can actually have lots of different learning experiences across different providers like MITx or edX, at Mozilla, lots of different places where I have learning experiences, I earn badges, and I pull them all into this single collection through the Open Badge Infrastructure in my backpack that I manage and I completely control, and then I can create groups and narratives and share them out from there. So again, the idea is about all of this working together to create this, allow the learner to create a more comprehensive story about their learning. So then on the final slide, this is just a few examples of some of the people that are already participating in this badge experiment, if you will, in the ecosystem. It's not brand new. You know, there's still a lot of sort of networks that we are kind of presenting it to, but there's a lot of people that are already well underway. Even though there's still some, you know, lots of open questions, there's a lot of people that are sort of diving in, and I think that's one of the most beautiful things about this is that, you know, at Mozilla we like to say less yak, more hack, and it's, you know, it's kind of like we've talked about a lot of these issues enough, there's enough of a framework here that people are interested in that we're seeing some big names dive in. And so, for example, Purdue University is the first university to do it at a university level, and they're offering 21st century skilled and extracurricular types of badges to recognize their students. NASA is doing robotics badges, and also using those badges as an on-ramp to internships and a bunch of the cool stuff that NASA does. ACT is really interested in thinking about how badges can sort of take their sort of assessments in to the next level and thinking about it in a more granular way. And the Clinton Global Initiative is really looking at this for adults about how we can use badges to recognize on-the-job training and help people change careers or find jobs with this recognition system. There's a few museums here as well there's a bunch of this kind of like out of school learning opportunity providers that are really interested in capturing in that and allowing kids or youth or adults to take it back to schools and institutions for credit. So there's lots of really cool stuff going on and lots of people involved, and my colleagues have my contact information as well as a few URLs for you to get more information. So thanks again. Have a great conference. Talk to you later.
Is it live or is it Memorex? My name is John Fritz from the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. I just wanted to share a little bit about some of the things that we're trying to do that I think ties into what you've been hearing about here, but also kind of how does this duck actually, you know, walk when we're trying to do some things here. So my presentation is based on about 5 years of data that we have been collecting, and probably the thing that, you know, we have found consistently the most right now is that since 2007, students who use our Blackboard learning management system, students who get a D or an F use Blackboard 40% less than students getting a C or higher. Sometimes it's 39, sometimes it's 42 or 43, but it's been consistent every semester that we've been keeping track of it. We've been doing some research, you know, in terms of, you know, how students, if they got this information sooner, what might it do for them? I want to be clear about one thing, though, is I do not believe that Blackboard makes good students. I am interested in how good students use Blackboard and what impact, if any, that would have on all students if we were to share that with them in sort of an aggregated level. And so I'll kind of talk about that a little bit more in terms of what we're doing. Based on what we had found, we tried to present to students a dashboard of what they could see in terms of their own activity. I know it's a little hard for you to see it in this format, but this is a login to our portal. Students log in through our MyUMBC portal. They go to their Blackboard course, and right along the left-hand side where they see the links to the course, along the right-hand side, there's a comparison of how active they are, both in terms of hits and sessions in the course compared to their peers. Now, if the instructor uses the gradebook, this Check My Activity will also let them compare their own activity with peers who earned the same higher or lower grade for any assignment. And from surveys that we have done with students, they're very interested in this kind of information. It's a little fuller version in terms of what they can do. But, you know, we also define what this is. We caution people about, you know, trying to game the system, that you're not going to compel or coerce a faculty member to give you a higher grade because you're more active. We do have a disclaimer that we are tracking this information, and that under FERPA, as an educational administrator with an educational interest, we're trying to use this data to help current and future students. We also have an optional opt-in survey that students are welcome to complete. I get about one or two of these a week as well. So what you did see is what we sort of called the wall of numbers. What we're now talking about maybe doing is changing the visualization so that students could see maybe in a more visual way how they compare with students in their own course. The one problem that we have had that we're trying to deal with is that not all faculty use the Grade Center. So if there aren't grades in the Grade Center, there's not a context to the activity. So one of the things we have been talking about doing is looking at GPA in the course and correlating GPA of students in the courses with their own activity. So these are just screenshots. These are nothing that we've actually built, but it's something that we're considering doing. So that by GPA bands would be colored, and then sort of the black dots are sort of the you are here dot in the course relative to your own activity. The other thing that we're trying to do is build a little bit more value into faculty using the Check My Activity. And with faculty, it's a little different. We're not talking about them comparing their own activity. What we are looking at is maybe they would be interested in comparing their course's overall activity to their peers, either within the institution or within the discipline. So on the bottom, what you might have is a rank of activity in the discipline compared to the course. And I want to be real clear about this. We've been doing this for about 5 years. Faculty can see this information themselves. It's a ranking of activity, not quality. There's a number of reasons why a course may or may not be active, but I always preface that, and you know, that's been useful for us as well. So, you know, if you take this analogy a little bit further in terms of sort of the comparison, you could have something on the top where the fact where the student sees how active they are in a course relative to their own GPA. And then you could also see beneath that how active is the course overall. Why might that be important for students? Think about it. If you're active in a course that is not, how much value are you getting in terms of the feedback? By contrast, if you're not active in a course that is very active, maybe that has some different value in terms of what you decide to do about your own engagement in the course. In the bottom there, we've been playing around with, you know, sort of the little stick figures in terms of, you know, visualizations of how active and numbers of people. It gets a little dicey when you start talking about a low enrollment course, identifying stick figures and their GPAs and things like that. So again, this is just sort of a visualization, and I'm taking the Clay Shirky advice of those who risk putting something out there to be critiqued learn the best or learn the fastest. And so I'm sure you will teach me the error of our ways in terms of what we're doing with that. We have gone from sort of doing our own homegrown approach to things to working with Blackboard on their new Blackboard Analytics for Learn. And so this is a report that we have now for our most recent semester in which we have final grades. Basically what this report is doing is it's confirming some of the things that we had seen with our own homegrown reports, but it's scaling up in ways that we just have not been able to do. So from left to right, the blue, yellow, orange, and green bars are the activity quartiles of students earning a particular grade. And the columns for the grades A, B, C, D, and F are the counts of those students earning those grades. What's interesting to something like about something like this to me is if you look at the least active A students, the green bar, they are generally more active than even the most active D and F students. Everybody follow me with that? There's a number of other reports where you can drill down into this further. When we looked at this for you know, our own semester, it was interesting. I had a chance to look at another institution that is running Blackboard Analytics for Learn. Very similar, what I call stair step sort of graph here, and it's been interesting for us to look at. What I've been sort of moving into now, though, is looking at how can student activity shine light on course design. And so with that in mind, you know, this is probably something that for those of you that run a course management system, you're familiar with something like this. There's sort of varying levels of usage by faculty. The largest use is, you know, sort of the Dropbox, you know, putting content up, students come and consume it. It's sort of a user and document management site. The next, and at our institution, that is overwhelmingly the largest use of Blackboard. The next sort of evolving use of the LMS that I see by faculty is when they start to employ some interactivity, communications, chats, discussions, things like that. It's a smaller group of faculty doing it, but for a number of reasons, I think it's a more sophisticated use of the LMS. The third area that I see that is probably the most intriguing and most fruitful for sort of looking at student engagement is when faculty start using assessments, when they start using practice quizzes and exams, when they're collecting electronic assignments, when they're using the Grade Center to give feedback. That's where I'm starting to see that the most interesting sort of uses of the course are designed to help students take more responsibility for their own learning. Now, if we coupled that with feedback to the students, then you start to get a positive feedback loop where the students and the faculty are influencing each other. That's at least my working premise that I'm working from. So an example, you know, from Blackboard Analytics for Learn, this is from our spring 2012 semester, the impact of the Grade Center on activity. For courses that don't use it is on the left, the courses that do is on the right. Some of you may be familiar with the EDUCAUSE Center for Applied Research on undergraduates in IT. Increasingly every year, students identify that the most valued function in an LMS is checking grades and feedback are the things that the students are wanting to see. So with that in mind, if you haven't heard a bit, I'd like to introduce you to one of our profs. Tim Hardy is an econ professor, adjunct, part-timer, who has been our most active Blackboard faculty by far for 2 years. Tim was never on my radar, period. Didn't know who he was, you know, didn't know what he was doing. When I started looking at the activity reports, I called Tim up and said, what are you doing? And he said, well, I came to a workshop that you all did where you were talking about a tool called adaptive release. If you're not a Blackboard campus, let me just explain briefly. Adaptive release is a precondition that you can set that students must meet before they can advance and see content in the course. So for example, in Tim's course, he does a syllabus quiz that students must take and pass before they can turn in the first assignment for credit. He's also a stickler for, he teaches Excel, it's an accounting course. He's a stickler for how students use pivot tables. I don't know how many of you stumbled through pivot tables before, but they can kind of get you a couple of times. And he got tired of answering the same question, so he created a 2 to 3 minute screencast video, created a quiz that students had, that was based on the video, that students had to take and pass to demonstrate that they had the skills of pivot tables that were gonna then be required on the assignment. Tim's built his entire course this way, using adaptive release. Universally, at the beginning, students hate it because it's unforgiving. You know, you can't go through B to B before passing A. Over time, though, what he's reported is that students are performing 15 to 20% higher on the department's common final exam for accounting compared to other sections of Econ 122. Now, what I wanted to do is just also kind of tell you a little bit of the follow-on effect. The graph is a little challenging, but let me just tell you what, you know, on a high level. Tim's students in 122 are performing nearly a half letter grade higher in Econ 301, for which Econ 122 is a prerequisite. Tim doesn't teach 301. So the students are performing higher in terms compared to other sections. They're taking those skills with them, the sort of, you know, the time on task and those kinds of things. If you're interested, Tim's, you know, students are in the middle pink column. The comparative sections are in the green column to the right. Everything in the middle is from 2010 on. Everything before is before 2010. Tim's own courses are in the purple 2.88. What I will point out as well is Tim's evaluations were high when he started doing this. They dipped when he started it, and now they're starting to come back up. What he's hearing from students is that they are getting through. In fact, he said that in all the time since 2010 that he's been doing the course, he's only had one student fail the course who completed all of the assignments. If you think about it, we have a lot of sort of feedback opportunities, you know, in action right now. I have a friend who is a diabetic. He uses a CGM, continuous glucose monitoring device, on the left-hand side. What's interesting is, yes, there's an alarm that will go off when his levels reach a certain point. But what he told me that was interesting is that through diet and exercise, he can now keep the alarm from going off. He self-regulates through the feedback that he gets. I think feedback is important. Nobody wants to look silly in a course, whether it's students or faculty. And so how do we create learning environments that give people feedback about what they want to do with their own engagement? In the top right, some of you are maybe familiar with an electric utility company, O-Power, was trying to get people to save, conserve energy, what they ended up doing instead of a multi-million dollar ad campaign. They started including in the bills for people's monthly utility bills a comparison of their own consumption with their neighbors. And people's utility consumption started to drop. Now, the downside of that is that people who were low, below the norm, they started using more. Okay, so, you know, there are some downsides to it as well. I'm a big fan of mint.com. I don't know if you use it. It's a free website for doing your bills and those kinds of things. What I like about it, though, is you can see how groceries compare in Baltimore, Maryland, or gas, paying at the fuel pump. And those kinds of feedback tools, I think, you know, are good. I think Deb showed some other examples as well in terms of what's going on. I've been reading a book lately called Nudge, which is by Thaler and Sunstein in 2008. What's interesting about this book is sort of the premise. They talk about design, sort of choice architecture. As administrators of systems, we have the ability to sort of design or architect the choices that people have available to choose from. I'll give you an example. At our institution, when we create a Blackboard course, it's sort of a blank, empty shell. One of the things, though, that we have learned from the Quality Matters folks is that it's useful to have a big Start Here button, a big Start Here menu for people, and that when you have it there, they will go there. To me, that's a choice architecture that creates a different sort of default state that people can choose from. I think that IT can help nudge, not necessarily intervene, but nudge people into decisions that would help them if they had all of the information available to them and if they were more likely to make those kinds of good decisions. And with that, I think I'll stop on that because we might have some other things we're going to.
Great. I am going to spend literally just about a minute going through some other examples to pique your interest, and then we'll have time for Q&A. Because there are a lot of different ways of approaching this idea of exposing learning analytics and perceptions of progress to students. OLI is probably familiar to most people in this audience. We love this example because they've been collecting learning analytics data and doing research on it for 10 years. And they've refined these user interfaces so that, you know, there's hints to help students get through the material. There's, you know, good visualizations for progress through learning objectives. And this is all fed back into the system so that these learning environments can become richer and more effective. This is a project, a research project by Eric Duval at KU Leuven in Belgium. And this is for students who are writing programs. This number one you see is goal achievement for all the students in the class. They can compare their progress to each other. And these other graphs are factors that are influencing their achievement, including they use rescue time to actually track what each student is doing at all times while they're working on programming activities. And that feeds into this kind of feedback loop. John mentioned Blackboard Analytics for Learn. This is the student view that the students see in the course that gives them a variety of different ways of looking at their activity compared to other students in the course as well as other students in their major. This is a publisher example you see here. This very clear example of perception of progress. This is how you're working through. And this part right up here I like because this this is where your standing is in terms of other students who are working through these same learning activities. And the other students are anonymized, but it still creates this motivation in terms of, well, I want to get to the top of the standings. Or to let students know, because they might not know that they're near the bottom of the standings. And so, in summary, these are all real ways of getting at what we think is a powerful way to not only create motivation, but also lead to more authentic learning opportunities. Thank you. And we've got time for Q&A. Please go to the mic because of the online audience.
Is this mic on? Hi. Can you hear me? No? Test? Okay. My name is Justin Beals. I'm the director of R&D at Macmillan Publishing. So we've had a challenge with this type of issue where we find that showing a student how they stand with the other students was actually a demotivator. And we had to remove all of that data from the student interface. Have you guys encountered this? And if you have, how have you successfully helped it be a motivator for students?
That's an interesting problem because I haven't had students, you know, complain to me, and I haven't had faculty complain to me that this has been a problem. But it is something that we're concerned with. You know, if at the beginning of the semester people see, gosh, I'm way less active than others, there's no hope, I'll give up now. You know, that would be the worst kind of thing. But all I can say is I have not been getting that kind of feedback. I hear the concern that you're raising. I'd be interested in how you learned of the problem and how it was defined to you, because I think that, that we could learn some things about that as well. Yeah.
Justin, was that a big open online environment, or was it like a specific class or community of learners? I think that makes a difference.
We were working with a homework system, an assessment system, so a student could measure how they scored against individual tests, or overall in all the assessments, how they were scoring against other students, just in the homework system itself. And when it cropped up was during our usability tests and small focus groups. So we didn't have a very broad group of people, but you know, some of our team is very traditional, and they get really nervous on any negative feedback. And so we didn't get to really push it forward in our product. As much as I think that, and I apologize for the tangent, but even the decision that I'm not performing well and maybe I should drop this class is an important decision that students should be allowed to
make.
That's
not necessarily a bad thing.
Right,
yeah.
Right. But it's become a communication issue in convincing people that it can be a good piece of data to provide them.
Yeah. Well, many different learning environments are implementing these kinds of comparative behavior visualizations, including Khan Academy and others, where it is actually just, you know, out in the open in a huge environment. So, but it sounds like it's an area for more research, certainly.
I just want to say I appreciate that you're doing the usability testing. The one thing I have learned a little bit is that there is a big difference between what people say they will do versus what they actually do. And so doing the learning analytics to see what the behaviors are to inform the design is helpful as well, but I applaud what you're doing in terms of the testing.
Thank you very much.
Yeah.
Are there online questions?
So I don't know if either of you can speak to this, but one of the online participants asked, this is about badges, if there's been any exploration about taking badges and applying them to skills for returning veterans as an alternative to traditional certifications?
Yes, I'm glad you asked. There's a very important project that's Badges for Vets, run by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. And they've initiated a number of badge projects, one of which is being run through Western Governors University. And basically what it does is, you know, what Aaron described here is it takes the skills that the vets have used in the field, some of which are well-defined, some of which are not so well-defined, but figures out how to clearly define those as competencies that can be badged and then recognized by employers and educational institutions. So at WGU, they're using it to actually give college credit for collections of competencies that vets have achieved in the field.
Still on badges, two questions. First of all, what are the measures or metrics or knowledge of employer take-up on badges? And secondly, how is it interacting with existing? Obviously, we have a whole panoply of existing accreditations and certifications and so on and so forth. So how does that part of the ecosystem play out? What's the scenario for that?
That's really interesting, and that's a question that I've been tangling with a lot recently and talking to a lot of people about, because it's really the question of you're going to have an ecosystem that's going to work end-to-end, you have to have the consumers, right? There's not a lot of motivation for students to create badges if they don't know how someone is going to recognize the value of those badges. And so there are already a number of different badge projects like the WGU one that I just mentioned, that translate those badges into college credits. So that's already starting to happen at various institutions. And then there are some things that are starting to go directly to employers. So for example, Carnegie Mellon University has a computer science for students network where students can use online environments to learn programming skills. And they can do everything from basic skills that they might apply to an assignment in a high school class, to actually
full certification that is certification that is recognized by unions and employers. So we think there's a lot of important and timely work to be done in terms of coordinating with government agencies, policymakers, unions, certifying bodies in various fields of employment to make badge credentialing systems compatible with the current modes of determining, you know, why you would hire someone or why you would give someone this type of opportunity based on this type of credential. I think it's going to be a both and. I think it's going to be a blossoming arena of a variety of combinations, in my own opinion. Other questions? It's kind of the reaction I get from various audiences or individuals with this combination of things, because it's a lot to take in, and I think it's an exciting and useful combination of ideas, but I'm not surprised that you're still busy taking it in. So if you have questions later, please get in touch with us.
Thank you.
Thank you.